I was so wound up about auditioning because they basically sent me four songs and then said, program all the keys stuff, come in
Yeah.
and audition. I got really sick, which come to find out looks good when you're auditioning for Nine Inch Nails because I look
Okay.
terrible.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Cloud Machine Podcast. My name is Matt Landry, and in the 70th episode, I'm here with Chris Pooley. Though the podcast we discuss musical directing, American Idol, getting versus keeping the gig, his professional path, influences, composing versus arranging, the music industry, and much, much more. We also play the producer's game. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast, a platform that allows us to learn more about the music industry through conversations with artists, people in the behind the scenes, music business individuals, creatives, and much more. This podcast is brought to you by Eights, a musical direction and playback company out of Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Our goal with this podcast is to create a resource of knowledge on the industry and shine a light on all the stuff that is happening in the music world, topics and realities that are gatekept, and the people and roles that may often be overlooked. This week, I have the immense, and I mean immense, pleasure of welcoming Chris Pooley to the podcast. He is a musical director, composer, and arranger, originally from Detroit, Michigan. He has been the musical director for American Idol since 2018, and throughout his career, he has worked with Katy Perry, Kesha, Demi Lovato, Adam Lambert, Rita Ora, Jane's Addiction, Smashing Pumpkins, and many more. Over the last decade, you may have heard his work through your TV on programs such as Glee, American Horror Story, and even the Super Bowl in 2015. I haven't had the chance to speak with Chris too much yet, but his career and path has been an inspiration for me throughout my journey. And I'm very excited to be able to chat with him today. So, without further ado, please welcome Chris Pooley to the podcast. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for that intro. That was glowing.
No, it's great. I've known about you for a very long time, and just recently went through this phase of just listening to a lot of like musical directors on just on interviews. And I know down your interview with Korg, with Adam Blackstone and
Oh, yeah.
David Cook a few years ago, that really changed the way how I saw musical directing in general. So yes, thanks again for taking the time this week.
Got it, man.
Let's start the podcast. So we always start the podcast. I want to ask you about your favorite live show experience as a
Oh.
fan. As a
Oh,
fan. So
right
as
in. Okay.
yeah.
Right in. Fans. God dang. There are okay, a couple I'm just gonna say what comes to mind.
Yeah.
There was a Gojira show at the Wiltern that I loved. That was
Yeah.
probably, I don't know, 5 years ago when they came through LA. It's just one of the cleanest, clearest, most emotion front forward. I love that album at the time too. I still love
Yeah.
Hail. Okay, that let's see, when I was in college, oh, there was a Screaming Headless Torso show, very weird band from New York that I was a
Okay.
fan of, and I drove from Detroit to New York to see them play at a little club. That was formative for me.
Yeah.
It just a tiny little room, incredible band, some of my favorite players in the world. Okay, that comes to mind. I'm a drum corps guy, so there's probably like a drum corps show in there.
Oh, yeah.
Just is I know it's different than what you're asking, but that's what I
No, it's
meant.
great. It's great. Do you think that throughout those three shows there's like a thing in common kind of thing? Like
They're all
what
loud.
they're all loud.
Yeah. I think that's about it. I think that's, well, no, musically they're kind of, it's all left of center. It's definitely not pop music. It's, the drum corps stuff is mildly orchestral. It's just different phases of life too. It's just what you're into at that time. And then certain things you
Totally.
kind of move on from, and or you see through a different lens when you get older. But yeah, it just sparks something in me creatively. Like the Gojira stuff, the metal stuff, I've
Yeah.
been listening to a lot more the last 5, 6, 7 years. And that it just fires something in my brain that I love. And so
Yeah.
most of my downtown listening, it's metal.
Nice. There's something about going to see like crazy shows that, for me anyway, you just want to sort of sometimes go home and like burn all your instruments. Do you get the same feeling? Like what, especially like for a Gojira show, like, and you mentioned like creative inspiration after, like after the show and stuff, like what, do you go home straight to the keyboards or stuff like that for yourself? Or
Yeah, it actually doesn't make me want to quit. It, I mean, some things have in the past, but
yeah,
but, certain piano players make me want to quit. They're so, you know, like Brad Mehldau, and you like, I think,
yes, yeah,
I'm never, you know, anyway, no, it's inspiring for me. I realize I'm not that good, when it comes to metal. And when I think of that, I think of it from a drummer's perspective,
right?
Mostly because I'm, you know, pretend to be a drummer sometimes. So yeah, so sometimes I come home and write. I usually come home and write, and then I have a little metal album that I'm working on the side too, just for fun.
There you go. Fantastic. Talking about projects, for those of you who don't, for those that don't know Chris Pooley, is there a project or campaign or era that would best represent your work? For those who don't
know? Probably what people know me for the most is all the Katy Perry stuff. So that's been the last 10 years of her music. Whenever she's done something, that's been me music directing or arranging it. So that's probably what most people, if they see something of hers and they go, oh, who did this?
Yes.
And they get in touch with me. That's kind of the Super Bowl being the first big one, other than just normal award shows.
Yeah. And can you talk about like the first time y'all connected? Was it through that word of mouth thing? Had her team seen like another project and been like, well, hey, who did this kind of thing?
That was actually a lot more just like a regular old fashioned friendships and relationships. And the guys in her band, I knew, I was friends with some of them, and I had worked with some of them before, but we were just friends. And then as Katie started to talk about like, hey, we should bring it, she didn't have an outside music director for the first part of her career. And she considered bringing in an outside music director just to have a different set of ears. She wasn't sure she even wanted one. And some of the guys in the band said, hey, do you know Chris? Have you met him? She's kind of like, I don't know. I guess maybe I should meet him. So they were doing a rehearsal, and I got a call from her management, I think that morning or the night before, and said, hey, would you mind swinging by the rehearsal and just saying hi? We don't know if this is anything, but Katie just wants to meet some people. So I just went by the rehearsal, and then she met me in front of all of my friends, the guys in the band. And interviewed me in front of them.
Right.
She's just, you know, it was funny. and then she said, okay, we'll work on this one song, something that she wanted something different on. And so I did one song, and then that one song has led to the last 10 years.
Well, and you know, I put myself a lot of times in the listener's shoes here and say, oh my gosh, you just got a call and you were able to just be there the day of or the day after. There's something about location, especially like in LA, and just even like being in LA a lot for music myself. There's just something about like being able to be there like quickly. Was that one of the reasons why you made the move? We haven't talked about that yet, but
you go to kind of where the action is.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to live in LA to do this, but I think you have to be willing, if something like that comes up, even if it doesn't pan out, to get on a flight and get there on your own dime quickly. And not tell anyone that you're, oh, let me see if I can get a flight. Just be like, yeah. And then, you know.
Yeah, just totally. Get
there. So if you don't live in LA, I think that's something you should be willing to do. And that goes for any position of anyone in the music side.
In this podcast, we do a quote segment. Last year, it was an Erykah Badu quote comparing the art form of music and the music industry. And this year, it's a Joni Mitchell quote. It's pulled from 2004 with an interview with Robert Hilburn of the LA Times. And she says here, I heard someone from the music business saying that they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate. What are your first instincts when you hear this this sentence here?
Well, I guess if I didn't know it was Joni,
yeah,
I would think that's a pretty cynical view of music.
Yeah,
I think just like any statement anyone makes, it has to live in context. And so yes, knowing Joni's life, knowing her setbacks, pretty well documented, even the writing of Woodstock, you know. So yep. I would think that that's a cynical take if that's your whole perspective on the music business, but there is some validity to it in when it comes to the music business, like the business of it. So
yeah,
I could see her double speaking like she's so cleverly does often as well.
Yeah.
And I think that she's right in one way. Yes. Because there is a and even for her career too, there was a particular marketability, there was do your songs resonate, the willingness to cooperate. They're just like in any relationship, there's give and take, you know. So
yeah,
if you're unwilling, completely difficult to work with as an artist, eventually I think that'll catch up with you. But do you know what year did she say that?
Yeah, so this is, yeah, so for a little bit more context, this is in 2004, so this is 20 years ago. And also, she said that she had heard somebody from the music business saying that they are. Then further in the interview, she says that she doesn't agree with this. And, you know, you're correct in saying that, like, Joni wouldn't necessarily say this for herself, but she had heard somebody saying yeah. that the music business was looking for this, you know, not yeah. necessarily looking for talent, but looking for somebody that they can just be like, oh, okay, do that, do this, and be able to cooperate, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting. But yes, 2004. So it's 20 years ago.
Yeah. I wonder what her take now would be. I mean, the music she's making now with Brandy and stuff is just, some of the most incredible stuff of her life.
Yeah.
And that Grammy's performance was, I just watched it again the other day. Yeah. You know, she just seems very thankful. She seems like she had a health scare and she seems thankful to be alive. And it seems like maybe some of the business wrangling and the place and stuff that's maybe in the rearview mirror. Yes. I would guess. I think she's just thankful to be here and making music.
Yeah, I'd hope so. Yeah. How is the business part of the music industry viewed on your end of things? You know, you spend your days, with artists, working with artists and stuff. How is the business part viewed in your day to day?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a couple different ways you can break out the word business, right? There's
yes,
money,
yeah.
You know, there's the professional aspects of what you do day in, day out, emailing, you know. So,
yeah,
I,
sure.
You know, it's the basic principles of business and business ethic, I think, apply, you know, as far as being on time, being responsible, being accountable, being teachable, you know, all those things in business. As far as the, like, doing money, that part can be tricky.
Yeah.
Especially in an industry where unless you're working on something that has a contract, a union contract, it's kind of the Wild West. And it's the classic, how much are you charging? And then the response, well, how much do you have? You know, that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm thankful that I have a manager that does all that now at this point. I have for the last about 10 years.
Yeah.
And I found it was helpful to pay someone else to have those difficult conversations, just because I'd rather someone else have that that's infused in their relationship, and I'd rather not have money infused in my relationship for creative things.
Yeah, like has that sort of have you felt it change your relationship with the artists?
Not really. Maybe with the managers, because
Yeah,
they don't
sorry.
know.
Yes, yeah. Artist camp management. Yeah.
Yeah, the managers don't have to deal with me and money, you know.
Yeah.
It's just if I'm working on it, it's already been agreed to and we just move forward, you know. And I, you know, and everything is scalable, right? Where it's I've heard this, the three aspects: music, money, people. Those are the
Yes.
three components,
The
and
gig triangle.
it has to be two of those.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be two. So, when deciding whether or not to take work, and I think this is true on any level, this should be, no matter how much it pays and no matter where you are in your career, I don't think you should jump at something that's only one of those. You know, unless it's, you know, your mom or your, you know, like someone has a, it's the, your mom's music is terrible and she's not paying anything, but it's like, it's your mom, you know.
Yeah,
So unless one thing is just so out of control, a lottery winner, you know, wants to pay you $1 billion, you know.
yeah. No, we hear it a lot. The gig triangle, the money, music, people. It's super important. Now, in regards to the industry again, where do you think the industry is going? Very general question. You know, we talk about a little bit about business, about, you know, music. Where are you seeing it going?
I have no idea. That's a good question. And I
Yeah.
don't, I mean, it seems, you know, it seems like a lot of things where with there's better player, there's more better players
Yeah.
now than ever. And better at not even just players, just better at everything because of the way we can access information.
Yeah.
And which in turn can kind of drive, you know, quality, money, all those things down. It just, you know, straight up capitalism,
Yeah.
comes into play there. And I think that that's a tough one because I feel for young musicians who just want to get their foot in the door, but they're offered money that's really not livable. And, you know, so I've been seeing it trending more and more that way.
Yeah.
And more artists that are established, older artists that, and they're being asked to take less and less. But the reality is that the artists are making less and less too. So, between ticket sales and things being bundled into their albums and stuff, like, you know, it's, I think that there's less and less money in the music business
Yeah.
every year. So it's a, it could be a tricky balance, you know, and there are certain staples like film and TV that they consistently renew their contracts. This is where I'm very pro union.
Yeah.
And it's nice, like American Idol's a unionized show. So thankfully we have those protections. But if the unions, if more and more shows, I know more and more TV shows are getting away with not using unions. So it gets tricky. Then it's
Yeah,
just how
yeah.
much money, you know, how much do you cost? How much money do you have? You know, so.
Yeah, do you have you been checking out what's been going on with Live Nation and how the government in the US has now declared it as a monopoly? How do you think that will affect it going forward?
I really don't know. I think it's
Yeah.
so, I dove into it a couple weeks ago. And I see a lot of artists speaking about it too, and I just think it's no one is really that informed about it yet. It's really
Yeah.
complicated. It seems very complicated to me. So, thankfully, that doesn't, for me and what I do, that doesn't impact me too much.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's fascinating. I mean, I think it's a shame when things, when it power is centralized like that, and money is centralized like that. And hopefully, you know, there's a way to redisperse that, but I'm not entirely sure what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gives opportunity to, you know, more independent shows or independently promoted shows, or these artists, you know, do their own shows in these venues, and you know, it doesn't necessarily always we don't always rely on Live Nation and Ticketmaster specifically for these shows, and that artists can, you know, pocket that percentage that they would typically take. So I think it's interesting. Wanted to talk to you about your origin story. Can you give me the lowdown on where you grew up and your creative upbringing specifically? So family, friends, maybe high school specifically.
Okay. Yeah. I'll try to make it short because it's sure. These, whenever I hear people's origin stories, I'm like, okay, we get it. You know,
yeah.
I hail from, you know, no, there's just, I grew up in a suburb of Detroit, Waterford, Waterford, Michigan. And, my mom's a singer. I grew up primarily with her. My dad is a sax player. And then my stepdad's a guitar player. My mom and my stepdad have a casual band, a wedding band. And I grew up playing in their band starting when I was like 14 or so. So I did about 10 years with them doing weddings and went to music school in Detroit, Wayne State, for jazz piano, I think is what I was, jazz performance. But, you know, thankfully I had great professors, and shortly into my college days, we all realized I was not a great jazz piano player. And they were very honest with me. They were like, okay, you're decent, you're fine, but they're very serious jazz heads. But what I was good at was arranging, and they were like, you should focus, let's just keep your major the same. We have some other 20th century music classes, which thankfully they had just started that program. It was with this composer, Michael Daugherty. It was incredible, with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. So I got to write for the orchestra, and I got to arrange. All through that, I'm also, I marched drum corps, I marched Crossman 96, and then I was making a living mostly teaching high school competitive marching bands and winter drum lines.
Yeah.
Anyway, so writing, just writing, a lot of arranging, writing. And then, then moved to LA 22 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
And then thought I wanted, so because I was doing so much writing, arranging, orchestrating, I was trying to get into film composing. That's essentially, I came to LA and, you know, sent all my demo CDs everywhere. You know, it was one of those. It was just old school manila envelope dropping off at offices. And thankfully, I saw, and that didn't go anywhere. Thankfully, I saw a breakdown of music careers, and there was a magazine. I don't know if it's still around. It's called Gig Magazine.
Yeah.
And thank God I saw this thing. It was like a breakdown. It was a graph of all the different music careers. It was like, you know, engineer, touring musician, film composer. You know, it just kind of went all down all of them. And then they had like all the different things. It was like average annual salary, how long it takes to succeed in your, you know, make a livable wage in your career, but you know, just all this time away from home. And film composer was just like, you know, it was like just a flat line for until you hit your 40s or so.
Yeah, sure.
So at that time, and this is pre the boom of TV movies, and this was still all features. So I was like, oh boy, I don't know about that. And I tried to get an internship, and it, you know, it was tough sledding for a minute there. And then I saw the touring musician stuff, and it was basically like you start making money right away. And I had a friend who knew a friend, and there was a guy in town, a guy named Barry Squire, that was like the central hub for bands to find touring musicians. I got to know Barry. He got me on a tour. I auditioned. I started with a small family band. It's a band called Just In Case. And then just, you know, slept on the floor of a Sprinter. We played Walmarts in the morning, and then we'd play a show at night. It was wild. It's really like clear
Walmarts?
Out the frozen. Yeah. It was like they clear out the frozen food section. We'd play a show.
Oh my gosh.
They'd be like, hey, you know, come see us at the local whatever coffee house tonight. And, I was just, you know, cutting your teeth. And then and the band couldn't have been lovelier and all that.
Yeah.
And then I'm just moving kind of quickly through this.
No, it's great.
And then got another audition with started playing with this guy named Kenna. Met some great people in that world. That was a Neptune's produced project. So got to know Chad and Pharrell a little bit through that, did some things for them. A friend. Then I was playing keys at a church. and with this drummer who's very good. And then he called me right after we left this church service. I was playing a lot of churches too. I grew up in church and playing in church and all that. You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
He said, "Hey, my buddy needs a sub on the road. They extended the tour, and he told his family he needed, you know, he was going to be home, and so he needs to keep his word." One of those kind of things.
Yeah.
And he said, "Can you sub for him?" I said, "Great." He said, "I didn't even ask who it was," and then got a call from the guy, and he's like, "Okay, it's Jane's Addiction. They're doing a European run."
Right.
This is one of those, like, can you, you're flying to Germany. I'd never been to Europe before. It was, you know.
Anyway. Sure.
Long story long. Yeah, so that was kind of like my first big rock gig. My, you know, and then I kind of bounced around to a handful of different gigs. And then it, you know, anyway, then it goes on from there.
Yeah. Do you remember a story of something that you saw, like, early on that, like, changed things for you in regards to, like, oh, like, this person is doing it, or like, oh, this is how you do it, this, or it could be also like, oh, this is actually something I could do, like, long term.
I've never, I mean, I've always been pretty, I don't know, self-confident, you know?
That's right.
Like,
and yeah, your parents just, as well, right?
Yeah, because I saw, you know, their lives. I saw that it's possible to make a living in music. And then, but I also, you know, I studied it and I played it every day, all day long, you know, it was like, but I also had, I think, because of their lives and what I saw in their lives and their friends' lives, had a, like, some perspective on it already, that usually it's just a lot of hard work, and that then you, you know, hard work and then you die.
Yeah.
So, so I'm, and I wasn't afraid, you know, being from Detroit, you know, the, being a blue collar town, the idea of just hard work and paying your dues was something that was fine.
Totally.
So, but yeah, I did have a few moments where it was like, where that idea of how I thought about myself was really challenged. Like the Jane's one, the one came to mind.
Yeah.
Growing up, I had kind of always thumbed my nose at rock.
Sure.
Just a little bit, because I was into 20th century music and, you know, so all the rock staples, and rock was kind of like my parents' music. So I kind of thought it was simple.
Sure.
But I was doing a show with Jane's Addiction, and I mean, I'd never met the band before I even played with them. They basically, they like, right before the show, Perry walked up to me, shirtless, of course, like right off, Perry Farrell, the lead singer, and he put his finger in my chest and he goes, "Can you do it?" I said, I think I can. Yeah. He goes, "You better." And then that was my only interaction with the band. But in that, I think it was maybe the next show or the show after that, he jumped up on the bass cabinet, which I was like kind of behind the bass cabinet. And he goes, he looks right at me. He goes, "Let's do Kashmir, Led Zeppelin."
Led Zeppelin. Kashmir. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And I was just like racking my brain. And I'm like, I know this starts with strings. I kind of know the figure, and I started doing all my like interval voice training stuff in my head. Sure. I'm like, da 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 da. Okay, so the fifth is going up. It's going ba da da. It's a wait. It's in minor, but the hook. This thing is in major. Ba da 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 da. I'm like, oh no. All right, so that is the, you know. So I was doing while they're like counting it off. So then I stumbled my way through Kashmir. I totally blew the ba 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 that section. I think I just picked my hands up like I am lost. But going in being very confident and then realizing like I have a massive blind spot in music, and I catch up real fast because I'm on stage with a band that's calling these Pink Floyd songs. They're calling Run. You know, like I mean, it's on
it's
stage
not,
and they know them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so so I took a keyboard back to my hotel room that night and just sat up and went through all as many of the songs.
Top 50 karaoke rock songs?
Well, no, I went through like AOL chat rooms at that time to see like their old set list and other songs that they would call up. So people post that stuff in those message boards at that time. This was 2002.
Yeah.
So... And then so I was like, oh no, they call that song. They stay up and learn it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, fantastic. Well, I was going to ask you about you know, an opportunity, a gig that really like changed your career path. Would you say that's Jane's Addiction, or was there another one that was like, oh my gosh, like this is like the big one?
Probably the big fork in the road for me was, I did a handful of I played with rock things where I was playing with like Susie Sue and then Liz Phair and just playing keyboards. And then what I thought was the biggest setback of my life, I auditioned for Nine Inch Nails, and when I did their With Teeth, that album, which it was before it was out, and I had it, and I was like, this is the best thing I've ever heard in my life. And I went and auditioned, and I was so wound up about auditioning because they basically sent me four songs and then said, program all the keys stuff, come in and audition. I got really sick, which come to find out looks good when you're auditioning for Nine Inch Nails. Because I looked terrible. I was just like sweaty and pale, and I had long hair at the time. And anyway, so I auditioned, and that audition was really funny because you're in a spotlight in the middle of the room. The room is dark. Then you hear these footsteps walk in the room, sit down on couches. Then you hear Trent go, "Hurt."
Wow.
And then you play Hurt, you know, and then it's a total silence after. And he goes, "Closer." And then you play Closer.
Oh my God.
And then they walk, and then they march their way out. And I did a couple of those auditions like that. And then met with them, and then they ended up going with another guy, which that ended up being, they were smart for picking the other guy because, you know, he's the best.
Okay.
Right after I didn't get that, I got a call to audition for Gwen Stefani.
Yes.
This was like literally the next week. I was bummed. I was like, all right, cool. Sure. and then I got that audition. And we showed up to the first day of rehearsal, and the playback guy quit right before, and he had all the tracks in Digital Performer. And it was one of those, like, Gwen, up to this point, she had never done a solo thing. She'd been in a band. And so no one had any idea about, like, because the band would just get together and jam and come up with the stuff and work on it together, that there was a need for a music director. So we showed up the first day of rehearsal. The rest of the band are people I'm all fans of. It was like most of David Bowie's band. And me and some of the guys that were No Doubt the horn players, who are all great friends of mine now. And they just basically looked at me and were like, what do we, you know, how do we do this?
Right. You're the guy with the digital instruments. What do we do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was using playback. Well, because the playback guy quit, I was like, I know Digital Performer. That's how I grew up programming and for my parents' band.
Yeah.
So I just had assembled all the album stems and chunks, you know, and then so then I was essentially saying, okay, you play this part, okay, I'll mute this part. It's just like the normal playback MD stuff now.
Yeah.
And then I was never, and then she had me write some intros and outros, blah, blah, blah. We did a whole tour. I was never the MD, but then there was a conversation kind of midway through that tour. I realized, like, oh, you're actually the MD. We're not going to pay you anymore, but you can call yourself that if you want.
Yes.
And then we stopped that tour short because she got pregnant, and so she had her baby, and then we came back a year later and then did a big long tour. And then I was MD for that. So that was my first MD gig. I just kind of fell into it because the playback guy took a Hillary Duff tour.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, that you're now all friends with these guys, and, you know, especially like the beginning with Katy Perry, it was all like through relationships. Just wanted to highlight relationships because we truly believe here that, you know, professional connections and friendships can help careers, you know, move forward. Looking back now, was there like one person that gave you an opportunity or that was like a sounding board early on in your career that you can remember?
Well, I mean, I could think of, as you say that, I think of like 3, 4, 5 people just kind of pop up in mind. Sure. You know, there was the creative Ray Woodbury, who was the creative director for Gwen.
Yeah.
Was sort of my first creative director I worked with. And he's the one that hired me for Gwen. Yeah, I mean, I could just, you know, there's people like him, creative directors, artists along the way. It is all relationships.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of ways that people are trying to manufacture relationships, I think, through apps and social media and stuff, but it's really the you know, it's easy, it's really easy to get your to get on a gig, to get your foot in the door, to like get an opportunity. But if there's something about you, some personal toxicity, or you're not good at your instrument, or you know, you're annoying, or sure, just something about that that you you just get easily, very quickly put out, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So and unfortunately I see that quite a bit now. And I have over the last, you know, 10 years especially, where people come in swinging and yeah, they don't, you know, they're
not swingers.
Yeah, there's something about them that people that rubs people the wrong way. And because, you know, everything I've gotten has been because the people on the job I was on or the tour I was on at the time, they like me enough to recommend me for the next thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's all about relationships and all about the hang, really. You mentioned something that I'd love to get into. You know, being a musical director means that you're responsible for hiring and firing. You've also been the hired session musician before, as you mentioned as well. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that getting the gig is really, you know, the first step into really just, you know, a thriving relationship with the artist. Can you speak to, as you mentioned now, sort of getting the gig versus keeping the gig?
Mm.
And, you know, you mentioned being a good hang, being, you know, great at your instrument, but also being on time and you know, writing great emails or at least good emails, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, most of it, unfortunately, is common sense. So if you don't have it,
yeah,
then I really feel for people who are lost in or don't have the ability to zoom out in an environment to realize their role, what's happening.
Yeah.
Something I talked to a guy recently and he was really surprised. I had said something just kind of offhand, like I don't have a picture with Katy Perry. Like I've never taken a picture. Like, hey, let's take it, you know, like,
yeah, yeah.
I'm in some pictures with her just because I'm in shot and they're taking a picture of her.
Totally.
But, and they were like, what? Like you, that seems crazy. And I consider her a friend and we, you know, do things outside of work. You know, our families know each other, that whole thing, but I've never, the implied familiarity that sometimes I think musicians get with when they're in a band, the idea that we're family, quote unquote, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
It's not really that. I get why people say that. And I think there's something heartfelt about that, but you know, in a professional environment is really what it is. It's about relationships, but it really is. It's the artist's business.
Yes.
That we're all working for, you know, so I think boundaries. Yeah. I think people, you know, I think the younger you are, probably the harder time you have with boundaries because there's so few boundaries socially now anyway, but
yeah.
That is one that really, that as far as keeping a gig, being mindful of your boundaries is a big one.
For those who don't know, you know, musical directing encompasses lots of like different activities, responsibilities, and hats, especially now in 2024. Can you speak to the balance between, you know, directing, composing, and arranging in what you do?
Yeah. Well, let me talk about the touring music side first.
Sure.
Because like American Idol and TV and composing, that's they're their own things. So on the touring side, which I don't know if that's most of your audience, but musicians, players, I mean, for music directing, it's probably there's a saying about these three too. You're part politician, part technician, part musician. You know,
sure.
So you have to have a strong musical base to know what to do. Someone says. You know, whatever someone says, or like what I'm doing with Katie right now, she has a new album coming out and now we're looking at her whole back catalog and we need to make the back catalog sound like this new record.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
So you have to be able to do that. You've got to be able to know all the different styles, know all the rules of the genres. Don't break those rules, but when you break them for a reason. You know, there's a lot of very relevant music things. Also, being able to arrange, play an instrument, at least one of them, well.
Yes.
have a, on the music side, have a network of people you can call upon to do things for you. You know, all the vocalists, guitar players, and other programmers, blah, blah, blah. Those relationships, treat those people well, pay them as best you can.
Yeah.
It's less money in your pocket, but it, in the long run, it's, it, don't try to do everything yourself. That's when I see a lot of music directors doing now that, that just kills me, because they're like, I can do this and I'll do this. And they'll try to do it all.
Yeah.
And one, it comes across as too creatively too, you know, just one thing. But also you burn out really quick and you can't do more at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. Usually when I'm putting together something, I'll have maybe three or four artists. I'm doing all their stuff all at the same time, you know? So.
Right.
Anyway, so there's that music aspect, which I could talk for, you know, probably too long about that. And then the politician part of it too is obviously being respectful of everyone's timelines.
Yep.
And,
sure.
You know, under promise, over deliver everything, saying, I'll, you know, when you say like, okay, okay, I can get that to you by Tuesday, then always send it on Sunday. Like, know that you can deliver it by Sunday.
Yeah.
So, stuff like that. And then the technician side, obviously, knowing if you want to be a music director, knowing how to do playback, knowing all the rules for players, knowing for every instrument, like, okay, that's not possible. A guitar player can't do that. I'm trying to translate this. A drummer, and this happens a lot with drummers and me, and it's kind of funny. Well, a drummer will go like, I don't think I can do that. I'm like, do you want me to show you how you can do that? Exactly. Nice. That. And then they go, okay, all right. So just know if you're saying that, you're not, you know, that you're not lying. How many samples they can cover and on what and what part. So the technician side, knowing the technical limits of at least what you're asking people to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And you mentioned for let's say the musician part of it, you mentioned, you know, handling like various artists at once, you know, three or four, as you mentioned. Typically, do you handle like associate musical directors or like band leaders, for instance, for like typical artists? Like you can't split yourself up in three to four people, even just like for rehearsals and stuff.
Right.
What is your typical process for that?
Well, I mean, yeah, sometimes an artist will have a road MD or a band leader. Every situation is different. Cause sometimes I get hired in just to arrange and there's already a system in place and there's already that person. But usually when I'm talking about music directing, it's more arranging for people's tours. Cause I try to not, I try to be very transparent about when I can and cannot be somewhere, you know, because I think the temptation when you're taking work is to just say yes and then figure it out later when you know there's a conflict schedule-wise. If you know there's a conflict, it's always best to just say, okay, I've got till this date. I can't be there physically then. I'm happy to send someone that's not me, someone that I work with. If that doesn't work for you, totally understand, you know, and then not try to take too much. One, it's just stressful. And then two, it's lying, you know? So, physically I'll make sure I'm only in one place at a time,
totally,
you know,
totally,
at least calendar wise, but then the rest of the time I've got some other people that work with me that are great arrangers and programmers, different styles. And I usually just will take a project and go, okay, I can physically do about a third of this. So the other two thirds, you know, I'll, Pete Dyer, can you do this song? Can you do this song? John Witt Jr., can you do this song and this song? You know, and all us MDs do that. And a lot of us use the same people too, and they're just great people. And then a lot of us MDs too, you know, like you talked about the Korg thing with Dave Cook.
Yeah.
So you're like, Dave, I can't, this is on the East Coast. I can't be in the East Coast. Would you mind jumping in and doing this? And great.
Yeah.
And, you know, so us MDs, we all communicate with each other too as much as possible. And if we need help, just say, man, I need some help here, or I don't have time to do this. You'd be perfect for it. Can I recommend you?
Yeah. And for you, is there a method? I want to say a method to the madness, but just like the organizing and stuff like that. You know, you're handling a bunch of different artist tracks, stuff like that. Are there tools that you're using right now to sort of get through the project, whether it's like an Excel sheet, even like things like that.
You know, I used to use Excel sheets, and then I had overlapping documents, and I get confused. I'm not good at that. So I basically just use iCal. I just block out. I say, okay.
Yeah.
We're doing that with the summer, saying, okay, these 13 days are for working on Katie's Rock and Rio set, you know, nice. And these, you know, and, so yeah, I mean, iCal, on Idle, we use Google Docs. So to know who has to do what, when, it's just all, we just share a Google Doc and update and who's making tracks for what and who's learning what part, and, you know.
Fantastic. I wanted to talk about Idol. You mentioned it. How's your experience been with Idol? I know you've been there since 2018. You know, I know it must have been a completely different process than any other artist that you'd worked with before. What was that starting like? And what's the typical sort of process there?
Mm. Well, I mean, I got pretty lucky, to be honest, because how I came onto the show was the producers were talking to Katie about being a judge.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so they went and saw Katie's show, was part of a meeting with her, and they saw the show, and they were basically like, who did this? And her manager said, oh, that's Chris. You should take a meeting with Chris if you're looking for somebody. And anyway, so I got a call from my manager and say, hey, they want to meet with you. And I thought it was to help the existing music director. That was my thinking. They wanted to maybe, because it was leaving Fox and going to ABC, and they're kind of starting new judge. Anyway, so I thought it was to kind of help arrange. And then sort of midway through the meeting, I realized like, oh, they're asking me to just music direct the whole show.
Yeah.
And so like in my thought process while they're talking, like, and I was like, yeah, I can do it. You know, like, they're asking if I could do it. I have to be honest. If I didn't think I could do it, I'd need to say that right now.
Yeah, sure.
Because this could go south quickly. So anyway, started 2000. We just wrapped my seventh season.
Yeah, congrats.
Last week. Thanks. And it's really awesome. I mean, it's very different than anything else in that it's live music, live players, all on the fly. Every time we play, it's a little different. We're refining every time.
Yeah.
I told someone the other day, and they were surprised to hear this, that when we do it live on TV, that's only the eighth time we have ever played the song. So
I thought it was going to be less than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we do one band rehearsal. And then, I mean, like, ever play a song, meaning like literally we just go top to bottom, move on to the next song, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, we have one band rehearsal. We run it once a band rehearsal. Sorry. We run it three times in a rehearsal with the contestant. Meanwhile, all those, they're also getting instructions about where to move and cameras and blocking.
Sure, yeah.
And then we do it three times for the, with cameras in our camera rehearsal. Just back to back to back.
Yes. And this is in the amphitheater, in the theater.
This is in the
studios, rather. Yeah.
On set. Yep. Yeah. It's all in the studio. Yeah. Then we have a dress rehearsal the morning of the show, and then we do it live. That's the eighth time. And every time we make changes.
Yeah.
So it's fun. It's really nimble, and the band's really good, and our nonverbal communication is really good.
Yeah.
And we've all got, you know, we know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and the friendship. That's one where the we're playing as much for each other as anything else. You know?
Sure. A lot of laughing, I'm sure.
Yes. And a lot of accountability too. So it's not, you know, we're about the business of doing it well. So, if anyone makes a mistake, I could probably count on one hand in seven seasons, the mistakes we've made, you know, and just because if we do, it's searing.
Yeah, yeah,
we
yeah.
No one wants to make a mistake. Anyway, so the process is very different.
than tours. And what I love about it is it's, you do it and it's gone. There's no working on it anymore.
That's
move
right.
On to the next week's songs.
The next week, yeah. And typically, like, I believe the show is now aired on Sundays. Is that correct?
It's Sundays in the States, yeah. We did Sunday and Monday shows a lot this year.
Yeah, okay.
We'd have back-to-back live shows.
And then typically, like, for a week's time schedule is, like, is it Sunday, Monday, like, break on Tuesday, Wednesday kind of thing, and then back in on Thursday?
Yeah, so say we did a Sunday, Monday show.
Yeah.
There's all these, so it gets complicated, and get it very confused because we're also working, like, 2 weeks ahead at all times. So say you've got 20 okay. contestants on the show. We know in 2 weeks we're only going to have 14, but we're still working on all 20 of their songs, although six of them will not make it that far, and six of them just go in the garbage songs.
Okay.
So that's where it can get confusing because it's like what's happening what week.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, so we do a Sunday 2-hour live show, Monday 2-hour live show.
Yeah.
Tuesday, we would be looking at the songs for the coming Sunday and Monday's show. So 4 hours of TV. So it would be, say there's 20 of them, there'd be 40 songs we're looking at. And so we're refining arrangements. We're making tracks for those. They're rehearsing with their coaches and we're getting piano vocal, like MP3s.
Yes.
And then we put them on the grid. We make tracks of the grid, exactly what those arrangements are that we grid them.
Yeah.
And then meanwhile, we're also I have a creative meeting. So we're going through all the creative treatments, Zooms.
And this is on a Tuesday?
This would be on the next day. Yeah. There'd be a creative meeting. Because everyone has to make all the lighting has to program.
Oh, 100%.
Video content has to get made.
Yeah.
Blocking. There's a couple other things that overlap here. And then almost always after a show, when certain people go home, then other songs become available and some contestants change their songs.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And then, or we'll hear a song and we're like, this is really not good. On our show, it's the rules are that the contestants are the final say on their song. So if we disagree with their song, we'll just present our case. I'll say, this is why I think this is a bad idea. And they can take that advice or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they usually will go like, okay, well, what else? You know, and I'll say, well, how about this? And then we'll look at that. And, or we'll say like, oh, this song is on your socials. You sound great singing this. Like, oh, I never thought about singing that. Like, okay, well, let's try that, you know.
Right. Anyway,
so it gets complicated. So that's Tuesday, Wednesday, more tracks, more meetings. Sometimes there'll be a band rehearsal on Wednesday, but usually it would be Thursday morning. We do like a 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. band rehearsal and then probably like the same day. And then, anyway, so on and on.
So it's assumed that during an idle season, there's not going to be much time off.
No, there are no days. No, there's no.
Right.
So sometimes there'll be a gap where there'll be like one Monday where there won't be anything crazy to do.
Right. Just, like a just only Sunday show kind of thing.
Just working on arrangements.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are no down days.
Very cool. And typically, like the season, this season was did it start in January?
Our first taping was in December.
Okay, December.
So we just do a week in December, and then we do one week in February when we go to Hawaii. Those are pre-tape shows.
Okay.
And then I start on the show again sort of mid-March with planning, and then we wrap end of May.
Okay, fantastic. Are there some musical directing tricks that you've acquired during this tenancy at Idol? I mean, you know. Or there's some things that you know you've learned along the way that is now cemented in the process for you.
Oh, that's a good question. I've learned it's important. I have a talk with all the contestants in Hawaii. Started doing the last couple of years because they all have similar questions throughout the season, and so I try to get in front of it. It's, you know what, it's such a human endeavor, the show. There's a lot of things musically you can pick apart, but it's a really stressful environment for people who haven't done music on live TV. And I really feel for all the, you know, contestants, artists that come on our show. So the things I've seen them go through are just real human emotional level things. I try to talk to them about it early and say, like, address the social media thing, address that you're going to get a bunch of attention, you know, that the things that people say, both good and bad, aren't necessarily true, you know, and to guard your heart and know that your coaches are there. If you need to talk about something and get something out, it's better to just talk it out, you know, and there's a lot of just, it's more just, you know, like, it's a music industry 101 as far as dealing with the public's opinion, what you sound like, what you look like.
Yeah.
And managing that is as much of my job as doing arrangements, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's because when we get ready to go do a song on live TV, I'm talking to them in their ear, and it's really, it's like everything else goes away. It's like being a boat pushed out to the ocean where it's like, everything, and then it's just us. It's just us making music. And after all the chaos of everything that they've gone through that day or that week, and a lot of them go through really hard stuff throughout the week, then sure. I have a moment to kind of talk to them, usually before, in their ear while the video package is rolling. I try to talk to them so they don't watch that because they start to cry a lot of times. So it's managing the emotions and their emotions on the show and letting them know that we got their back, we're there. If they fall apart, we'll stop. We'll wait for them. Don't worry. It's okay. You know, just things I would want. And a lot of them are younger, and me being a parent, a lot of things I would want as a parent, someone to say to my daughter if she were on the show.
Right. Fantastic. Any tips for MDs or musicians that have a quick turnaround time? You know, you mentioned 40 songs a week sometimes or idle.
Well, I mean, there are only so many hours in the day, so managing your workload best you can. Bring in help. Be willing to not make anything in order to deliver. Sometimes, especially early on, I would be in the hole on a project. Try to be responsible. Don't be dumb. But if it means you delivering and maybe not making as much as you hope to, it's better to deliver. And then next time ask for more money, you know, so just knowing what it would take. But, you know, good. That's another three thing, right? Good, fast, cheap, right? You get to pick two.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's okay to say if a project, they need you to turn it around really fast, then say, don't say I need more money. Say I need to bring in some help on this because the turnaround is so quick. So it's going to cost a little bit more. Just saying like, I'm going to need more money like that. Yeah. That's a see you later. That usually, I mean, it's just, if you want to deliver, then, I would frame it that way.
Fantastic. Talking about like, you know, a lot of like musical directors and stuff, a lot of like things that happen around, you know, you talk about fast turnarounds. I want to talk about just musical directing in general and maybe taking inspiration from other musical directors as well. And just like, you know, you talk about collaborating with guys like Dave Cook and stuff. How do MDs sort of stand out in the music industry while it's not necessarily their job to stand out?
Mm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, some MDs are kind of, you know, celebrity MD types. And I think that's fine.
Yes.
That's not my style. Everyone just has their own style, you know?
Yeah.
And the way like Adam, that he's done Blackstone, the way that he's done his business, it's great. That's what he does. And he likes being in the mix, and he does a great job. And he also has a team and great people that work with him. You know, Dave Cook and I are probably more, we're kind of the same person, Dave and I. Just he's smarter than I am and funnier, but but the way that we work is such where he's also, you know, Midwesterner, and you just do the work. And if you need help, ask for help. It's another great MD, natural. That's Ariana Grande's MD, and he's a friend. And get in a pinch, or there's something. We've had a few things this year where I got the call for it, and I just felt like natural would just do a way better job at this than me. He's just better at this, that particular style.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we'll text and be like, did they call you for this yet? Because you should really do this. He'd be like, yeah, they called me for it.
Okay. So, yeah.
I mean, people usually they'll cast the net wide.
And you know, like you're saying, like your community and your network, you know that like this individual is better at this stuff, or that's more, maybe not better, but that's just like their bag, you know, something like that.
It would be a better fit. And I think just being honest about that, because then saying yes to something you're not good at, or you know you're not going to do a good job at, that's not doing you any favors. Totally. You may make a couple dollars, but in the end, people will be like, not that guy. And they'll tell other people that too. So
totally, because the word gets around quick. Mm-hmm. Are there pros and cons for you to the music industry being so relational?
Pros and cons. I don't know. I wouldn't think of it that way. I would think that the relational side of the business is just life. It's just like just like any relationship, and there are things about it that can be complicated, and there's always it can be gray, you know. So there's a lot of gray areas about what's appropriate, and relationship implies there's feelings as well, you know. So if you feel left out of something, or you feel too included, or you feel, you know, there, that part can be tricky. But that's just like any relationship. And I think if you look at your immediate circle and you're good at relationships in general, you know, I'll be honest about how that's going,
totally.
You know, then you'll probably be fine in a relational oriented industry.
Yeah. I wanted to shift a few last questions here. Think about the listener again, probably a lot of, you know, MDs, musicians, artists, how could one grow their prospect in the music industry, music business? Is it truly all patience, connections, and experience, or is there, you know, more than that?
I think luck is one, unfortunately.
Yeah, totally. Yes.
I mean, right time, right place. But I think eventually, if you're around enough, you'll end up being right time, right place. And it's, if you're prepared, then you're doing okay. But if you're not prepared, you know, you're screwed, sort of. You know, I think, you know, like if you're a drummer and you get hired to do something and you can't do it, you know, that's if you know you can't do it, don't go to the audition.
Yeah.
You know, if you're I think you have to know that you can do a good job wherever you're at. And what I see a lot of times is just people not doing a good job with what they're given. And
yeah.
It's usually not hard. And it usually doesn't have anything. It usually doesn't have anything to do with music. I mean, there are a lot of good players, but it's something as simple as reading the entire email, you know, and you'll see at the bottom, oh, there was a Dropbox link to my upmixes for my parts. And I'm dumbfounded at how many auditions I've done, and half the people go, oh, can you send that to me again? You know, like,
yeah.
What? So, and people that have done auditions for me and people that know me know it's just full of those stories. And I am not shy about telling people those stories too, because if you're dumb enough to do that, then, you know, I'm probably going to use that as a warning for other people. To not hire you.
For sure. If you had to redo it again, just all your career, what would you do differently? And as well, are there things that you would have liked to learn earlier in your career as well? It's a two-parter, you know?
Yeah, two-parter. First part, I don't know if I would have done anything differently. I mean, I've mostly just gotten lucky.
Yeah.
I've gotten lucky by having people look out for me. And people that are, you know, that were honestly good friends of mine also work in other environments and then recommend me for those environments. So I honestly, I don't think I would redo anything.
It's great.
no, I haven't. Yeah, I haven't really thought much of that. And I maybe there it's in there, but I don't really like to look back on a past I can't change.
Yeah, that's great.
You know. So,
yeah, the second question is. Yeah, are there things that you would like to learn a little bit earlier in the career in your career?
Yeah, well, the rock stuff, like I talked about earlier, I wish I hadn't thumbed my nose at any genre of music early.
Right.
There's only so many hours in the day, so you can only learn so much. But I see this happen often with people where they think down on pop music.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
So when they have to play it, there's already this environment in their brain that they are dumbing down what they can do. Mm. And even if they don't say it, you feel it. You're like, why? You know. Anyway, you can just tell when.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Someone feels like they're dumbing their skill down, or their whatever they're playing is beneath them. But conversely, you really feel it when people are really good and they're really excited to play the most simple pop, you know, right down the middle.
Yeah.
And the people I know that work a lot are those people. They're monsters. They can play anything, but they will just play the most simple thing right down the middle and be so happy to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And any general tips for those looking to bolster their prospect? In the music industry, I think I'm typically thinking about musicians. You know, I don't know, we haven't necessarily spoken lots about that, but, you know, hiring musicians, are there things that you're looking for specifically now in 2024, other than, ego, things like looking at the whole email, things like that. Any general tips?
Well, yeah, I mean, love it or hate it, social media is like the way that we find people or gigs. Yeah. It's always when someone says, oh, you should check out this person, always go to their Instagram and you look at the first couple things. So make sure you have a video pinned at the top of what you actually do.
Yes.
And you doing it. So if you have to dig for like a guitar player, like playing guitar, you must not be good. You're not. You know, or there's something there. So always, if you're a singer, have a video of you singing pinned somewhere up at the top that's not tuned. It's not part of an album. It's you actually just singing.
Yes.
You know, so just be real. And that's nearly almost it. Because when I'm looking around for players or someone says, oh, can you send me links to the band? That's what I'll do. I'll just send a link to the Instagram.
Yeah.
And I'll find a picture online and the artist or the managers, they'll do the exact same thing. They'll click on it. They'll see what the first pinned videos are. And
yeah. Oh, fantastic.
That's it.
What are you looking forward to right now? Last question.
Good question. I mean, I think musically there's a lot that I've done that I'm pretty happy with.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think I've got to do more than I ever thought I'd be able to get to do, you know, so I'm not, you know, there's certain things with like, oh, I'd love to score more. I'd love to.
Yes.
You know.
Is that still in the cards for you?
Like, yeah, and I get those opportunities. Yeah. And I do. I mean, I have all sorts of scoring things I do that aren't film related. Just writing for the show Awakening in Vegas last week. So there's that scoring. And I have a sort of a steady commercial workload too. So scoring for commercials and then lots of, you know, different branded content stuff. You know, you do like a BMW film, you know. So
sure.
So I get to do those, but I haven't done really any features.
Yeah.
So there's something, you know. I would love to do that. But that also feels like it's a little Spinal Tap-ish where you're kind of like, now I get to work on my opera, you know? Yeah. It's if I get to do it, great. I feel ready for it. And, you know, I would love to do that. But I'm also happy to just grow where I'm planted too. So I like a lot of things that are outside of music that I, things that I need. I need to be outside, like fly fishing in the summer is my thing. So I usually try to take off.
Nice.
And spend a number of weeks in the woods with my feet in the water. You know, that's a big priority for me because I realize if I don't do that, then I get wound up too tight with music.
Yeah.
So the things I look forward to are, having a, you know, hopefully having property in the middle of nowhere that I can fish. You know, that sounds a little old man of me to say that, but it's, you know, it really is a, something I think about probably too much, but yeah.
I'm sure.
But yeah, musically I've been very lucky and I'm thankful that I get to even do it. And so every week it's like, oh wow, I can't believe I get to still do this, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, fantastic. I wanted to conclude with a game that we do on this podcast specifically for you. I thought about doing one of the games here it's a fun game just to see where your influences are, but where you are at currently in your music career. It's called the Producer's Game. And it's basically for us getting a chance to know what you would do if you were an executive producer for basically a dream album of yours. Now this is like dead or alive. So I basically ask you, you know, who would be putting this out, like the artist who would be putting the album out, some of the producers on the record, composers, the band, who would be in the band, and then some fun questions here. Which studio you would record at, what city you'd record in, as in you could bring Abbey Road to New York, the era of the album, as in is it, you know, a 70s, 80s record, is it a futuristic record, and then lastly, you know, what would be the topics of the album.
Question.
I know it's yeah. it's a big question. We could take our time. We could also pause here as well.
Yeah, no, let me think. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, I don't know if I'd want to do the bringing someone back from the dead.
Sure. That's
because
great.
Because I feel like if I put this sort of idea out in the world, it's something that could actually happen.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah. That's how I don't want to start with this is never going to happen.
No, you're in a great position to make this happen.
So, yeah, totally. It would be something pretty gratuitous. Like it would be like John Williams. I mean,
do it.
Like reimagining the Radiohead catalog.
Oh my gosh. Like now you're speaking my language now.
So his harmonic sense, all his John Williams isms applied to that tonality. Maybe not with that instrumentation. Or would it be Radiohead doing John? No, it would be John Williams doing Radiohead. Like that, where he uses their melodies and their progressions, but with all his French horn stuff and all, you know. So it would be that. It'd have to be, obviously, the LSO, Lennon Symphony. Obviously doing it at, well, you couldn't do that, Anvil. It'd be Abbey.
Yeah.
Probably, but it might be nice if it were closer to home. But I guess I could move Abby here. But then it wouldn't be – the whole point is it's there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Or just somewhere close to my house so I could walk there. The Raleigh,
there you go.
Raleigh Studios could, down the road.
Or you could bring it into the woods so you can go fly fishing.
That's a great idea. Yeah, so we build a sound stage, environmentally conscious campsite that we could disassemble after.
yeah, exactly.
And run enough power to, the generators in the woods. Anyway, so it would be Williams.
Wow.
Does Radiohead?
Yeah.
And Chad Blake, maybe he engineers it.
Fantastic. Same band, like Lynn and Radiohead kind of thing, or just without Radiohead? Like,
I think there's no Radiohead. I think Tom York's not singing.
That's great.
I think it's Johnny Greenwood could be there. He can do his part.
Yeah. Johnny could be there.
Yeah.
Some arranging, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's up to you.
Yeah, I wouldn't touch it. I literally would just be in the room just to enjoy it.
Fantastic.
That would be fun just to hear what he would do with it.
Yeah. Well, Chris, this is how we end the episode. Thank you so much for being my guest on this week's episode. It was so insightful to know a little bit more about, you know, your journey, your day in and day out. And honestly, thanks for answering the email.
Yeah, and thanks for reaching out. Appreciate it. It's been fun.
For the people listening, please visit poolymusic.com for more information on Chris and to get in contact if ever. To follow him on socials, his Instagram handle is at Chris Pooley. That's with a K-K-R-I-S, Pooley. Go check out some Idol highlights recently and to keep up with his projects. Also looking forward to that metal album. So there you go. I also want to thank those who are and have been listening and watching the Cloud Machine podcast. We like to keep this platform, as interactive as it can be. So please leave your comments, questions, and reviews down below. And don't hesitate to subscribe to get the notifications, but also to keep in the know of what's happening in the music industry. You know, we like to have these conversations with people that aren't necessarily always highlighted by your Instagram or your TikTok or whatever you're listening to. So yes, please don't hesitate to keep in touch. As always, everybody stay safe and see you next week. Thanks.